Welcome in, everybody, to the Thursday edition of The Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Got a good show coming up for you here today. We have a returning guest who's been on before. You know what? I think we had him on True Crime Tuesday the last time we had him on. And we've had him on an edition. Was it True Crime Tuesday or Darkness Radio? I'm trying to think now. But we're bringing him back on Darkness Radio because we're getting a little bit more into the conspiracy side of things. This time around, who am I talking about? Well, I'm talking about Daniel J. Duke. And this time we're talking about his new book, Secret History of the Wild Wild West, Outlaws, Secret Societies, and the Hidden Agenda of the Elites. Daniel Duke grew up in the hill country of Central Texas, surrounded by a wealth of stories related to Jesse James and lost treasures. After high school, he earned an associate degree in communications and a bachelor's degree in environmental science. His childhood in the Texas countryside, along with his education and professional background, has intertwined well with his passions, which have guided him for over two decades in researching the mysteries involving his family, specifically the noted Old West outlaw Jesse James and lost treasures associated not only with Jesse, but also with other individuals and organizations throughout much of Western history. His hobbies include hiking, writing, genealogy, history, beekeeping, treasure hunting, researching symbols and codes, healthy cooking, and good coffee. There's a lot we have in common there. And let's bring him in now to Darkness Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome Daniel Duke to the program. Hi, Dan. How you doing?
I'm doing good, and thanks for having me. It's an honor.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you back here, Dan. You know, when we last left you, somehow we skipped a book here. We didn't have you for your second book, which I'm sorry we didn't. But
that's
when we, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was blaming COVID for a lot of that. It came out right in the heart of COVID. So it was kind of, it's a good book, but it was COVID.
that's more than fine. The last we left you, we were talking about, Jesse James and the different symbols and treasures that were out there. And that there was a map that if you laid this map over the U.S., you could trace it to different areas of the U.S. And we were talking about how it lined up and how you could tie it to how this treasure was almost set up to bring about a new free America. Can you kind of recap for our audience why that treasure was laid out the way it was? And why Jesse James was involved with that?
Yeah, when we got into the research, it was mainly my late mother, Betty Dorsett Duke. She had grown up all her life as all her siblings, and even her dad had grown up hearing the same stories that Jesse James was their grandfather, and that he had faked his death and lived to an old age here in Texas. And, you know, growing up, she wanted to prove once and for all whether that was right or not. So she started her research, got family photographs. And to make a long story short, along with a lot of the photographs and stuff, the treasure maps were passed down, some treasure maps in the family. So they weren't normal treasure maps. They were more, you know, like a lot of, like you see on a movie, X marks the spot 40 paces from the old oak tree, you know, that kind of thing. This was geometric designs with no landmarks mentioned. And I always wondered what the designs were about. And a lot of people in the family had tried to figure it out. And then as I got to researching more, we knew that Jesse was a Freemason under his alias here in Texas.
Okay.
That intrigued me. So, and that gave a clue. Mom came out with her first book. I think it was after her first book came out, there were, I'd never met so many Masons in my life until that point. I mean, there was guys that come out of the woodwork and you're like, oh, I'm a Freemason. They would mention it. And I thought, this is strange. It's interesting. And it intrigued me. So I started digging further into it long before, and I'm getting all, there's a million rabbit holes I can go down on every part of this. So I'm trying to remember your original question.
How
how it tied in.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Jesse had buried a lot of treasures. And as I kept researching that, I realized he buried more than he'd ever robbed. And, you know, we had a list. There's a list in the history books you can find where he'd robbed so many bank stages and trains. And it amounted, you can add up the amounts that they got on each robbery. And it didn't even come close to the amounts that he'd buried in one catch that I knew about. There was an eyewitness who told us about the treasure. It was 700 bars of gold, each weighing 15 pounds. That's a lot of gold. And he'd never robbed that much gold, mm-hmm. according to every source I'd ever found. So I thought that made me wonder, you know, where's all that coming from? And then we met the attorney general for the state of Texas, Wagner Carr. He was a former attorney general. He had told us a lot about the treasures, had his driver show us some catches. I started figuring out how the grid system worked. I discovered it and then found out how it worked and the meanings behind it. And I wanted to know who did this. So I started tracing it back from Jesse and Freemasons. It always ended up with Freemasons. And I thought, okay, I was convinced that this had to do with Freemasonry. I just didn't know how far back it went. Or whether it was good, bad, you know, what were the motives for all this? And it led me all the way back to Sir Francis Bacon. I thought I'd found the guy who was finally responsible for all this until I realized that when he was only basically the midway point, pretty much. I found out his mentor, John Dee, traced that back through different alchemists, Rosicrucians. I mean, it was, alchemists, Jewish rabbis, all the way back to Rashi, who was the favored court guest of Hugh, the Count of Champagne. Okay. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. All the way back to one of the founders of the Templar. And then I went back to Sir Francis Bacon kept popping up and, you know, researching Manly Palmer Hall and his writings and specifically his wife's writings, Marie Bauer Hall. Mm-hmm. She had written a lot about a treasure that was buried at the Bruton Parish Vault in Williamsburg, Virginia. And she shed a lot of light on that, where along with the other Masonic authors and others. But it dawned on me when I read Sir Francis Bacon's The New Atlantis, it seemed to be a template for what America was meant to be. And then when you applied all the other stuff I'd learned around it, esoteric teachings, different writings, it all lined up to sacred geometry as a tree of life template with the grid, which symbolizes three veils. And I believe the only people I could pin that on were the descendants of the Knights Templar and the Freemasons, Rosicrucians, and allied groups who wanted freedom. They wanted to practice as they believe. They wanted liberty. And I truly believe that's what that's the reason for the treasures and the layout they were buried in. Now, I hope I didn't go on too long about that.
No. In fact, I think I remember from our initial conversation, we had talked about it before. You know, a lot of people are under the misconception that, and especially in this day and age, are under the misconception that our forefathers were Christians and that this is a Christian nation. It's far from it. The forefathers were Masonic. They were Masons. Everything in the Capitol is measured out in a Masonic measurement. If you go to the Capitol, everything is perfectly measured out in Masonic measurements.
I agree.
And so when you look at how this country is formed, it's formed. Even when you look at the Constitution is formed under Masonic rules. So I struggle to think that, you know, especially like I said, in this day and age, how people try to comprehend it as anything other than that. And how they try to wrap themselves around something that doesn't exist. And this isn't an opinion piece right here. I mean, it's fact. that's just the way it is. You know, that the separation of church from state is
exactly
is a typical Masonic creed. So with that being said, we know that the Constitution is a Masonic document. We know that as you've pointed out, these treasures are little caches that are there. And in that book, you pointed out that these caches are available essentially to start building the country in the image of, as Francis Bacon put it, this new Atlantis, or this new free country, so that people can practice the way they want to practice.
Exactly. And I believe that wholeheartedly.
So let me ask you this. This is going to seem like an odd question, Dan. Bear with me here.
Okay.
As I understand it, in Freemasonry, when they bring somebody in, they bring them in because they're of good character. Isn't Jesse James a bank robber?
That's true. That is true.
Where is that? That's kind of an oxymoron, isn't it?
That is true. But I'd wondered the same thing.
Okay.
I thought, okay, I know they're not the mafia. You know, they're the Freemasonry, they're not the mafia. Now, mm-hmm. some I've heard people who would think they're much worse than that, but you know, everybody's entitled to their own opinion. But I know Jesse was considered of good character to his peers and the people around him.
Okay.
Half the country viewed him as a modern day Robin Hood. And that's also part of that is due to great PR from one of the John Newman Edwards, who was a reporter who just seemed he had the highest admiration for Jesse and the James gang. But there was that that goes back. I have to give a little background on that. Jesse, sure. You know, grew up. He was in the Civil War. Before the Civil War started, fighting had been going on for about a decade before it the official beginning of the Civil War. And there were fighting between Missouri, who was a pro-slave state, and Kansas, who was a free state. A lot of people in the rural areas, especially like Jesse at the age of 13 and 14, he didn't care so much about politics. He was farming at the beginning of the Civil War. He was farming he was plowing the fields. Some Union-backed guerrillas rode onto the farm, strapped him to a plow, beat him severely, pushed his pregnant mother around, and there's different accounts on what they did to her, but they hung his stepfather until he had brain damage. They didn't kill him. He just had brain damage from then on, from lack of oxygen. So in his mind, and I know I would have thought the same way at that age, he wanted revenge. But he tried to join the Confederate forces, who he knew were enemies of the people who just attacked him. He was too young and they wouldn't let him, which shocked me because I've heard stories of other. There were some young kids who fought in the Civil War, but Jesse found the nearest group who would allow him to fight with them, and that was Quantrill's guerrillas. And they were very good at killing their enemy. There's a lot of accounts on both on you know, everybody's got their devil they're after. Now, the descendants of people that they had attacked claim that they were bloodthirsty, rape, you know, they would rape, rob, and pillage. Well, their enemies were doing the same thing. But there is no account of the James gang or Quantrill's guerrillas ever raping or harming women or children. Well, there was a botched robbery at one time where somebody accidentally, their horse ran over a girl and killed her. Okay. That was at the Kansas City Expo. Mm-hmm. They robbed a ticket booth. It was credited to the James gang, and a girl got killed. So that it was accident. It shouldn't have happened. It was terrible. But other than that, he was considered a good guy from a lot of people. After the end of the Civil War, they weren't granted amnesty like the rest of the Confederate forces. He tried to surrender. He was shot when he was riding in. They just opened fire on him. He got a bullet through his lung. And basically, they had a choice of either leave the country, turn yourself in and die, or live up to the brand of outlaw. I also have a feeling it's a lot deeper than that. I'm not sure how deep it goes. Some of the stages they robbed, I've been told that some of those were basically going after documents that were the target. I don't know if they were fighting carpetbaggers who were sent down to, you know, to basically take advantage of the situation and get wealthy off of it. I don't know if it was a warfare, some underground reason. There's a lot of theories, but the fact is he was an outlaw, but he didn't want to remain an outlaw. And that's why he faked his death and changed his name. And he changed his name and was living a peaceable life in Texas years before he faked his death. And he was wanting out. I apologize. I continue to ramble on.
No, you're fine, Dan. You're fine. I just wanted to kind of interject here and say, you open the book in a place that's very near and dear to my heart. As I'm here in the state of Minnesota, and you start in Northfield, Minnesota, which in modern day lore is the beginning of the downfall of Jesse James.
Yeah.
In fact, we have a little festival in Northfield, Minnesota every year, Jesse James Day.
Yes.
They do the reenactment and they have the parades and all of that. But that's not where your story really begins. In fact, you have a different telling of that story. In fact, you contend that Jesse wasn't even there. That because of that bullet that's in the lung, that Jesse wasn't, he planned it, but he wasn't there.
There's a lot of people. And one other thing before I get into that, the other part of, Masons let in men of good character. Mm-hmm. And I agree. I believe that wholeheartedly. But if I've had some people act offended when they found out he was a Mason. But the thing is, I always pointed out, and I forgot to this time, if you go back far enough, the Templar were outlaws at one time. So, there's a lot of they were considered outlaws. So there's a lot that I believe they were of good character, but they were forced into a situation that I think there's some similarities there. And I just usually leave it at that. There's still a lot of questions. True. I'd love answering. True. But
you can draw the parallel. They were outlaws from the French government. And then eventually, if you want to believe the narrative, they would have took off to the seas and eventually become what we now know are modern day pirates.
That's so true.
Yeah.
As far as Northfield, the James gang, a lot of times they would hit several targets in several states, 100 miles away within a matter of days. And they weren't riding that far that fast. And there's some cases where Jesse couldn't have possibly been in both places. But one thing they did as guerrillas, they would break up and hit multiple targets during the war. And that's where they got their tactics from that made them so successful with the bank and stage and train robbing. They would split up. And now a lot of people like to claim, no, that was definitely Jesse, because they want to know that. I don't know. That'll bring up another question I'm always curious about. Mm-hmm. But I believe it was Wood Height, his first cousin, who was in Northfield and headed up that raid, or was a major part of it anyway. Frank was there, and I don't believe Jesse was. According to Jesse's diary that's been passed down through the family, he was in Blevins, Texas when that raid happened. So that's another main reason we don't believe he was there. It was, his diary claims he was in Texas. There was another point I was going to get at a minute ago. Now I forgot the other point I was going to get at. There's so many rabbit holes. I try to keep focused and my mind's fighting, trying to go down each little path. But anyway, they practiced the guerrilla tactics, and that's another reason I think they were so successful. But and also one of the main reasons he got away and was able to fake his death, even the Pinkerton Detective Agency, who were the cream of the crop back then for detectives, they always got their man. They didn't know what he looked like. The only people who could truly identify Jesse were his family or his fellow gang members, who in some cases were also family. So it's there's a lot of descriptions of him during robberies that varied. Sometimes they'd say he was 5'8", 5'10", 6 foot, well over 6 foot. Nobody had an idea of what he really looked like other than family and friends.
Well, then on top of it, you also mentioned in the book that his wife at one time got caught with some hair dye.
Yeah, she'd been caught with hair dye. When you say hair dye, it always reminds me of the exhumation in 1995 where they tried to prove that he did die. And then my late mother, I always use the pun, she shot that story full of holes. So their story and the science they claimed they used doesn't add up. And that was always interesting to me. But the funny part about the hair dye and that exhumation, they claimed that they had a sample of Jesse's hair. And now a man who's now an attorney, at the time he was a Clay County commissioner, Stephen Caruso. He had possession of the hair, and the court ordered him to hand that over to Professor Starrs, who headed up the exhumation. Professor Starrs was a law professor. He wasn't even a forensics expert by any means. That was a hobby of his. And on a case of that significance, when you're affecting history, you'd think they would have wanted a legitimate forensic scientist, but they didn't. Starrs got a court order to get the hair. Caruso didn't want to turn it over. He said on TV it was a tawdry sideshow the way the whole thing was run. But he said, okay, I got a court order, I'll turn over hair. But he didn't turn over the hair from the museum. He pulled hair out of his friend's head, who was a Clay County Parks director, John Hartman. And he said he laughed when they studied the hair and found out that John was dyeing his hair. So, and that was kind of a funny joke between the two. But he could guarantee the tooth they claimed they got the DNA from didn't come from the grave, but he didn't give us details on that. And I don't know why, but he said, I guarantee you, I know for a fact that tooth did not come from any of those graves.
Really?
And that's all he would say. Yeah.
Wow.
So then there was a lot of the proof. He didn't give us proof on that, but it was an eyewitness account from a former Clay County commissioner and a current attorney. So, you know, there's that. And then with all the facts we gathered around it, the exhumation doesn't hold water. It's baseless. I mean, they don't have anything to base it on.
Interesting indeed. I'll tell you what, Dan, let's take our break right here. When we come back, it turns out Jesse James isn't the only outlaw in the Texas area who faked his death. We'll find out what other outlaw was within a day's ride of Jesse James and had more dealings with him than we might have known. Our guest is Daniel Duke. The name of the book is Secret History of the Wild Wild West, Outlaws, Secret Societies, and the Hidden Agenda of the Elites. We have a link in the description of this show that you can go to and get a copy of it right now. You can also get copies of his two other books, and you can link these stories together and exactly find out about the maps that Jesse James put together with these hidden treasures. And by the way, we also are going to ask in the second part of the program, Dan said when he was with us before that he might actually go out and take some of these maps and see if you could find some of the treasure. We'll find out if Dan ever did track down some of that treasure. We'll find that out in the second half of the program here. We got a link in the description of this program so you can get all three of the books and track down the story of Jesse James completely here throughout his life. So when we come back, not only will we talk about the other outlaw that faked his death and was just within a day's ride of Jesse James, but we'll also find out, did Dan ever get a hold of any of that sweet, sweet treasure? That's coming up next on The Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to The Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. My guest is Daniel Jake Duke. The name of the book is Secret History of the Wild Wild West, Outlaws, Secret Societies, and the Hidden Agenda of the Elites. It is available right now, and we have a link to it in the description of this show. We've also got a link to Dan's website up as well at the description of the show. Take a look at his website as well, so you can get a hold of all three books that Dan has out there on Jesse James right now. Dan, first of all, tell people how you're related to Jesse James. I know we kind of covered it at the beginning of the show loosely, but tell people exactly what your relation is to Jesse.
Jesse is my great-great-grandfather. On my mother's side, it was my mother's great-grandfather and her dad's grandfather.
Wow, that's kind of cool. So just to kind of recap for people, because I know we went over it in the first show, but tell people how exactly you found out that Jesse was your great-great-grandfather.
Well, the story had been passed down through the generations ever from him on, that he didn't die, faked his death, and he lived an old age here in Texas, in Blevins, Texas, specifically Falls County, the town of Blevins in Falls County, Texas. It's about 22 to 25 miles southeast of Waco, Texas. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing, what always struck me, we went to Kearney, Missouri, where Jesse grew up and, you know, visited the James Farman Museum. And the country in Blevins looks strikingly similar to the country in around Kearney. It was it looked like if he was going to pick a place similar to his home, that was perfect. The story had been passed down through the family. My late mother had wanted to know who was right, the family or history books. And because, you know, she grew up believing that. And then she goes to school and some of the history books she'd read claimed that he died. He was assassinated and died at a younger age. And then so she wanted to know who was right, who was wrong. Had our family photos taken to she looked at them, but she didn't want just our word. She wanted professional evidence, you know, professional, just proof from the professionals, whether he was Jesse or not. So she took the photos to the Texas Parks. It's the Texas Department of Public Safety. They call them the DPS. They're our state police. Mm-hmm. Their headquarters in Austin, Texas, and their forensic photographic analysts verified that our family photos matched Jesse, not only Jesse, but his other family members too. We had photos of Jesse's mom, and we compared those to historically accepted photos. They were even wearing the same dress, same missing arm, same dress, the same print on the dress. It was amazing. So she went from there to the Austin Police Department, and their forensic photographic analysts verified the same, you know, the same findings. And she went to a third group who was called Visionics at the time. They were world leaders in facial recognition technology. They sold it to the military, to international airports and stuff like that. And they also verified that our photos matched Jesse and the other family members. So we had that to go by. And that's when Mom contacted the James Farman Museum. We were all excited. We thought they'd be excited to know that Jesse didn't die, like, you know, from the dirty little coward who shot Mr. Howard.
Right.
And they didn't want to hear anything about that. So we couldn't figure out why. And they just started attacking her constantly online, on genealogy forums, everywhere they could find her, they would attack her. And it got worse. It ended up with death threats being sent to my mom, myself, and my sister. And the FBI fortunately stepped in and put a stop to it. So, you know, and the guy who was behind it admitted that he not only admitted that he did it, he named all the group of people behind it. And they were all tied in one way or another with people involved with the James Farman Museum. So it's disheartening when people do that kind of thing. And then I always wondered at the motive. And I don't know if it was money, pride, or a mix of that. I don't know. But I did know, I found out that the James Farman Museum at that time was bringing in $7 million a year.
Ooh.
And that was a very poor, yeah. So that serves as a decent motive, I would think. So,
yeah.
It shocked me. It shocked me.
Well,
yeah.
Well, Dan, there's no money in an outlaw dying peacefully at home.
Yeah, that's true. Well, and then, we went to visit the house in St. Joseph, Missouri, where he was allegedly shot. And even if he had been a very short man, he wouldn't have needed to step up on a stool to straighten a photo, because the ceiling in that room was extremely low. I mean, you could have been a very short person and still reached it fine with a feather duster. There's a whole host of evidence showing that he didn't die, as history claimed. So we were satisfied. The last big proof we had, other than the photos and all the facts and stuff, and his diary and a lot of the other evidence, was mom. There was when they did the exhumation in 95, they claimed that there were no living descendants who carried that same strand of DNA. They were looking for mitochondrial DNA. And they'd researched, they had searched far and wide looking for one. There were none. And so they found a group of males who would be the last in the line to have that DNA, and they tested them. They were completely wrong. And they all knew very well there was a female descendant of Jesse's family who carried the same DNA he would have had. And she lived, her name was Sue Laura Hell. She was in her 90s, and she lived in California. My mom contacted her and asked her if she got permission from her asked her if she could submit some DNA. Mm-hmm. And so her doctor drew some blood, sent it by strict chain of custody, not to us, but to a doctor in Texas who specializes in doing DNA for any. He does a lot of court cases with the FBI, federal, state, and even local law enforcement, and very well respected. It was all strict chain of custody, and it showed, we tested that against moms, and it showed a definite relation, that they were definitely related, according to the doctor. And I like the way he did it. It's just a long trail for that. To make sure all our I's were dotted and T's were crossed, we would have to get mom's sample and prove that she was descended from her dad, and then her dad to his mom and his mom. So we would have to get DNA samples from multiple graves to prove this. We're ready to do it. It's just half the family hates that, and they don't want anything to do with it. No. So they fought us in court to try to stop us from getting DNA samples, and claimed it was a violation of sanctity of the grave. And all you had to do was bore a small hole into the grave without exhuming the grave and just retrieve a dime-sized sample of bone to get that DNA. We tried to explain that to them, and all they hear is you're violating the grave. Mm. And we found out later that the half of the family that was fighting us had been, according to some, had been given monetary or gifts of monetary value from people related to the group that was fighting against us in the beginning. I'm trying not to name any names to avoid getting a lawsuit, but that's how it works. So... it's just a lot of trouble to hide the truth, and they still can't hide it because the facts are all over the place. I mean, so the way I'm doing it is just going the same route mom did. We've got the DNA showing a definite relationship, very close relationship. And then all the other proof tells the whole story my mother proved it, and my sister and I vowed to continue her research. And just the additional evidence we found was enough to fill a couple of books. And that I'm very satisfied that we've completed that journey.
There you go. What was Jesse's name when he moved to Texas then?
James Lafayette Courtney. And that was the name of one of his cousins from Missouri. So, and oddly enough, the cousin was the cousin whose name he took. He kind of just disappeared. He changed his name, and that whole Courtney family, who were cousins of Jesse, they would change their name from Hahn to Andrus to Courtney. There's a lot of name changes. It makes it real hard to do your genealogy when there's a bunch of name changes like that. But they had done that. The funny thing about the original, the real James L. Courtney, he was a Union bugler. So you've got a guy claiming to be a former Union bugler. He didn't only rob and stuff. He used the pension from his cousin who fought for the North. He got that pension money. And he also he lived very peaceably surrounded by former Quantrell's guerrillas who also moved down to Blevins, Texas. And that's just something that doesn't happen. He married the daughter of a Texas Ranger who lost several sons in the Confederate, who fought for the Confederacy. And that was a rough time in history. And I doubt they would have, especially Quantrell's guerrillas, I don't think they would have been best friends with a former Yankee bugler. Right. I mean, that just nothing against Yankee buglers. I have no problem with them. But after sure. You go through a war like that, I don't think it would have been that easy. And the thing, there's a lot more. The descendants of those guerrillas who lived around him all knew, they all know that and all grew up hearing the same story, that was really Jesse James. So it's interesting to talk to people like that.
So why aren't, if these guerrillas know that's Jesse, how come they're not taking shots at him?
Yeah, well, the guerrillas fought with Jesse, and they were all comrades during the Civil War. So okay. Yeah, if they thought he was a Yankee bugler, why weren't they shooting at
right.
him?
Right.
That wouldn't make sense. So,
yeah.
And I doubt the Captain Barron, who was his father-in-law, would have let him marry his daughter.
Right.
Barron himself, he had a steam mill in Waco. It was a cotton gin and a steam mill. And he was contributing to the Confederate cause all through the war. And right after the war, during the Reconstruction period, the Union took his business from him. So I doubt he would have welcomed a Union man into his family and said, yeah, marry my, I know that happened, but there's just a lot of things that just don't add up with the whole story of him being a Yankee bugler, the alias he was living as. It was interesting. So,
the worst kept secret in Blevins, Texas is sitting there my question would be, why is it that none of the authorities that have tried to come after Jesse James don't just come down to Texas and try to extradite him?
Yeah, that was another thing. One of the wanted posters, and we found this years ago, was one of the wanted posters for the Jesse, Frank, and the Youngers stated that they were often in the Dallas, Texas area, known to ride alongside Texas Rangers. And, that a lot of the Texas Rangers were former Confederates. And it was interesting that they rode with lawmen. But a lot of people think that's hard to believe. But if you look at especially like Texas Rangers, for example, a lot of those guys were former criminals. And if you read the history about a lot of Texas Rangers, nothing against the Texas Rangers. I don't want to get a speeding ticket or anything. but back then, they were known to ride both sides of the law, quite often. It was one day they're a ranger, the next day they're rustling cattle, stuff like that. So it was a weird time to live in. I'm sure it was very exciting, but.
Yeah. So Jesse isn't the only outlaw who decides to move down to Texas and change his identity and decide to live a whole different life. There's another outlaw out there who's within a day's ride of Jesse in Blevins, Texas. Why don't you tell us, Dan, who the other outlaw is who decides and has ties to Jesse James, who decides, I'm going to do the same thing.
Yeah, just the research on that was amazing to me. Brushy Bill Roberts is what he went by in Texas. And, researching Brushy Bill, there's a huge controversy around him as well. He's alleged to be Billy the Kid after Billy the Kid allegedly faked his death. Now, people are claiming he faked his death. I know Pat Garrett was a Freemason. That's another Masonic tie in the story. Mm-hmm. Pat Garrett allegedly shot Billy and put him down, shot it. And the funny thing was the way their deaths allegedly happened were very similar. A friend shot him in the back, that kind of, and it was a former or fellow in Pat Garrett's case. It was a former gang member turned lawman who put Billy down by shooting him in the back or shooting him in the dark. A lot of people, and they've got a lot of evidence pointing to the case, Brushy Bill's case, that he was Billy the Kid. And it's interesting to me that he lived near Clifton, Texas, which is just a, it'd be maybe an hour's ride by horseback, if that much, from where Belle Starr was known to have had a farm. And Belle Starr was queen of the bandits. She was well acquainted with the James and Younger gang, and she was acquainted with a lot of outlaws back in the day. We've got photos of her at Jesse's farm during Frank James's wedding to Annie Ralston. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it just keeps getting more and more interesting to me. We've got photos of Jesse and Frank at Blevins, at the house in Blevins, getting married with some of their friends who were known members and identified by current their descendants who live in Blevins today. And here's the other thing that amazes me. I'll get back on topic. Sure. Jesse's neighbor in Blevins, it was a man named Frank Krause or Krause. I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it. It was Krause, but Frank Krause was the maternal grandfather of Bonnie and Clyde, Bonnie Parker. And I thought that's just insane to me. It's strange. It's a fact. It's just very weird that he would live right next to Bonnie's granddad. Yeah. And one of the treasure maps that were handed down through the family, we were given when it was given to my mom. I remember my aunt, great aunt Judy, handed her an envelope with one of the treasure maps in it. And in the envelope was a clipping of Bonnie and Clyde's death. And I always wondered why that. I still wonder why that was in there. But knowing the connection with his next door neighbor and friend, who was Bonnie's grandfather, it just shows more of a tie there than I thought there would have been. It's strange. But back to Billy is believed to have faked his death. Many believe it, and they've got a lot of evidence. He faked his death, moved to Texas. He was about a day's ride from Jesse, as was Belle Starr. On top of that, Jesse had met Billy in 1879 in Las Vegas, New Mexico, July of 1879. And they had discussed, it's claimed they were discussing forming a new gang. It was after the Northfield, Minnesota fiasco, the debacle.
Yep.
And Jesse wanted a new gang. He wanted a more powerful gang, and he went to Billy. I thought it was odd. They didn't join up. That didn't happen, but I thought it was interesting that just a couple of years after their meeting, not even 2 years, well, about 2.5 years later, within that time frame, they both allegedly were assassinated in almost the same way. And then both moved to Texas. It almost sounds like they planned it out. It's very strange to me. Oh, well. There's a lot more outlaw connections. I was going to mention Jean Lafitte.
Yeah, sure.
His nephew. Yeah.
Before we get to Jean Lafitte, let me ask you this question about Pat Garrett. You mentioned the Masonic connection there. And mind you, I do have to ask, is there any Masonic connection with Billy the Kid? Was he a Mason?
I don't know. I don't know if Billy ever was a Mason.
Okay.
I haven't found anything stating that he was.
But we do know, of course, that Jesse's a Mason, Pat Garrett's a Mason. Do you think being that Billy and Jesse do have this loose relationship, at least we know it's at least a loose relationship, do you think that maybe feelers are put out somewhere that, hey, you know what, maybe you can help us out here and you know, let it slide. Billy's going to go straight here. He's going to go on the land.
That may have been, I don't know. That very well could have been.
Cause it seems to me, I mean, the way you're describing things here is the exact same way that, you know, we had a period of time here in the, I'd say it was probably in the 30s and 40s in, you know, Minnesota, Wisconsin area in the lakes areas like White Bear Lake and even in Wisconsin in that area where we had like Ma Barker who would have a cabin on White Bear Lake and she would She would make cookies for the kids, and she would play the perfect mom or grandma character, but, you know, was one of the most dangerous gangsters in all the land. You know, but she would play the perfect house mom, you know, because she needed a summer home, you know. John Dillinger would stay in St. Paul. I mean, Minnesota would be a summer place for him. So the fact of the matter is that, you know, they would come up here for, you know, for a summer getaway because it was cooler up here than, of course, it was in the Chicagoland area. So my thought is you've got this little cadre of criminals, for lack of a better term, they're in that Texas area, and they're all within a stone's throw of each other, but it seems like they're all wanting to go straight, so they're all kind of on the lam in this one area. Kind of like, you know what, if we're all going to go straight, we might as well all be in the same area. We all can share good times, and, you know, we can all figure out this life on the lam together.
Yeah, that's true. It could have been that way. I personally think that Jesse had more, I think he continued some of his activities in different ways. I know up at late into life when he was an old man, he was in his 80s, he was still he would hire, like, George Roaming, a man that I met, George's past. He was a former World War II vet. He died, I think it was 2006 or 2007. But George had, when he was a child, Jesse was an old man, and George told, he was a Freemason also, a Scottish Rite. He told my mom and I that Jesse swore him to an oath of secrecy, and hired him to help him move the 700 bars of gold. And it was just, I know, and Jesse was old at the time. He was still actively involved with burying treasures and taking care of stuff up until shortly, you know, a few years before he died, when he just couldn't move anymore, you know, couldn't walk around or get around much.
Yeah.
I thought that something, and during the Great Depression, he and some of the other guerrillas that were still alive, George said they'd ride around in a brand new Ford. They always had, you know, Fords. And if something went, the slightest thing would go wrong with one of their cars, they'd buy another one. And this is in a depression when everybody's having a hard time. He claimed they helped keep the banks in those little towns around them going. And I thought, how weird is that? Going from being a bank robber to helping save some banks, and it helped the whole community. Hmm. So I would say that showed they were, I don't know what it shows really. I mean, that could be viewed as they were actually good people, you know, or at least in their later years, trying to take care of the community and giving back. Or it could have been a whole different ballgame. Maybe it was a duty that they were sworn to take care of. I don't know. There's a lot of questions that I don't know if I'll ever find all the answers, but it sure leaves a lot of food for thought.
That's crazy. So you almost have to ask yourself the question, if they were knocking over banks, did it have something to do with the owner of the bank? Because at the time, the banks weren't insured. So
that's right. Yeah. Well, you know, with Northfield, Minnesota, for example, the mm-hmm. bank that they hit, the guy who, I was researching, and I've got that somewhere in a box in my records. I wish I had it with me. There, one of the guys who was part owner of that bank what was his name? Silver Spoons. They called him Silver Spoons. He was a Union general. He was very brutal and came through Louisiana. He was known for his brutality. He even ordered a barn full of slaves to be torched. You know, there were slaves in there who they were freeing, but he had it torched.
Okay.
The guy was just mean. There was also one of the owners of that bank on the board was friends with a Rockefeller and was known to vacation and play golf and, you know, I guess visit for a summer with one of the Rockefellers. And I thought that's interesting, because there's also a story that Jesse had robbed a train and had taken one of the Rockefellers' watches that was a pocket watch that was a family heirloom. And according to that legend, and there's no proof to verify it, the Rockefellers had a price on Jesse's head. When I read that about the connections of people who were involved with the bank in Northfield, it made more sense to me that maybe there was some truth to that legend about the pocket watch. Maybe he was striking back at it. I don't know. And maybe it wasn't just Jesse. Maybe it was some other reason they were hitting the bank that was owned by those people. It was more of a strategic play than anything, not just they're not used to being robbed, so we'll ride up north and rob them. I think there was a lot more to it than just that.
Right.
And I think it also transcended the line. I don't think it had to do with north versus south. I think it was something deeper than that.
Yeah. There was some sort of vendetta play there, but it not quite sure what it was. So you were talking about Jean Lafitte and how the connection there.
Yeah. In Jesse's diary, the town I live in right now is Marshall, Texas. Jesse had gone through here on train, and he and some of his gang members who were around Blevins, they hopped the train and came up, came through Marshall, went to Shreveport, got out. Well, before they got to Shreveport, they got to the Red River and they got on a steamboat called the Amelia LaBarge. And they rode south down the river on the steamboat. They got off in Nacogdoches, got a ferry across the river onto the Louisiana side, and then got more horses, rode north. No, they also hopped the stage. They robbed that stage. Then after they robbed the stage, they let the stage go. They got on horses and kept riding north and stopped at the house of a man named Gervais Fontenot. Well, Gervais Fontenot, I thought, okay, who's this guy? Every name I come across, I have to research as far as I can.
Sure.
So I'm researching Gervais, and I was curious about why. The first thing I found about him, he was a retired U.S. Marshal. And I thought, why would the James gang stay at the house of a retired U.S. Marshal? That didn't make sense to me. And so keep researching. I did his genealogy and found out he was the nephew of Jean Lafitte. And I thought, that's interesting. I got to reading more about Jean Lafitte, and that just tied in with, because there's treasures even around Marshall, Texas, that are purported to have originated with either Jean Lafitte or men who were with it. Mm-hmm. So I wondered if that was part of the same treasure network or the organization. And sure enough, Jean Lafitte was said, and this is in a Masonic website in Louisiana, he had Masonic communications with Andrew Jackson during the battle, before the Battle of New Orleans. Hmm. And he helped save he helped win the day against the British at that time. I thought that was really interesting. It was like he was a privateer to some, a pirate to others, kind of like Jesse was a Robin Hood to some and a villain to others.
Yeah.
And it's just, and Jean Lafitte himself was a Mason. And the reason I said that is he had Masonic communications with Andrew Jackson. And you can't have Masonic communications unless both parties are Masons.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that only stands to reason. So I thought, okay, there's that. And it just adds to the story. I mean, it keeps going further back. The pirates, the legends of pirates having connections with Templars in the past. And, it's very interesting to me. And it's almost like multiple webs that just keep layers and layers of webs. And each string connects to the other and to other webs. And it can wear you out, but it's addictive at the same time.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, but intriguing nonetheless. And almost exciting, when you see the level of communication and cooperation that had to go on in order to get some things accomplished,
That's true.
Yeah.
And that's another person, Jean Lafitte. Nobody knows where he's buried exactly. They claim he was buried somewhere in the Yucatan Peninsula, but nobody knows for sure. And that's just another. Then there's legends that came out of that claiming he didn't leave. He lived a peaceable life to an old age in Louisiana. I don't know how true that is, but that's just a legend. That's an interesting legend to try to track down one day. So right now I've got my hands full and I wish somebody else would take up that side of it. So
there's only so much you can do, Dan. There's only so much work you can take on at one time.
Yeah, I wish I could live for centuries just so I could have enough time to complete all the or search all the mysteries involving every part of this. So
that's true.
That would be nice.
That's true. Speaking of searching mysteries, at the end of the last show that you were on with us, you said, you know, I might take some of these maps of Jesse's and go out and see if I can find some of this treasure. Did you ever end up doing that?
I've looked quite a bit. I've found where some were. As I'd mentioned earlier, Wagner Carr, the former attorney general for Texas, had sent his driver to show my mother and I where some very large treasures were. And I know about the one that George Romling told us about, the 700 bars of gold. And that's on Fort Hood. I'm not touching that. I'm not even going to try to touch that. So if it's still there, it may have been recovered as well. So I think a lot of them have been recovered, but I have found, it made me happy to know that I'd found where some were. I went to one in Oklahoma and we were real close to it. It was, we had permission to be on the property. There was another property next to it that I think it may be on. Okay. But on the property we were on, I found a J, two J's carved in a limestone rock jutting out of the bottom of a ledge near a spring that they were said to have camped at during a blizzard. And you could tell it had been carved long ago because the weathering on the carving, you know, they were well rounded off and that amazing standing in the same spot. My great, great grandfather camped out at during a blizzard and finding his initials on a rock. That was just amazing. That blew my mind. I've got photos of it. It was just that. I think I put that photo, I have them in one of my books. I think it was in the third book, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Anyway, that just blew my mind.
I got to ask you this, Dan, with all this treasure that's been moved around and put in different spots and even having, I think you said it was George Browning telling you that he had helped move 700 bars of gold. Was there ever anything that was left to your mother or left to you?
As far as treasure?
As far as in a will. I mean, yeah. Was there any monetary?
We've wondered where it all went, but I think I believe the treasures he buried were for a higher purpose. I think it falls in line with the same treasures from, you know, that and all the findings I made with Francis Bacon. It ties in with the Bruton Parish Vault and Victoria Peak in New Mexico. I think it was for a much, and I know that sounds corny to some people, but I do think it was for a much higher purpose. It's not meant for one man. And I at first, of course, I would love to find some and just discover it. I want to say, and you never know what you would do, I guess, until you come to it. But I want to say that if I found it, I would just cover it back up and let the right people know and just leave it at that. But as far as us being willed anything, we weren't. Like when he died at the age of 97, half his children stayed back at the house digging up the yard instead of going to the funeral.
Really?
And I thought, that's a shame. That was a shame.
Yeah.
One of his sons was the head of that. And then a couple of his daughters stayed behind with him looking for the treasures. And the rest of the family went to the funeral. And I thought that was a shame. They also lost the farm because he willed it to his wife, his survivor. That was the third wife he'd had. He left it to her. She was a good woman and they fought her. They took it to court and ended up in the hands of the attorneys. Jeez. So they got it, sold it to a farmer. And that was that. There's a lot of stories from that. The farmer who got it, some of his cousins have told my late mother and myself that they knew for a fact, the man who got it, his son had found several treasures. So I did some tax records search in that county and found that the guy in the 60s, mid 60s, went from a meager, normal farmer, you know, with a meager living to buying up tons of land, and all of a sudden he had a whole lot of money. And I thought, how did that happen? You know, it's like a farm. He didn't have a bumper crop when nobody else did. I mean, it was right. Just that was interesting. Just kind of you know, some little red flags popped up all over the place that day.
Let me ask you this, Dan. So if Jesse were alive today and he were to see that you were pursuing these projects, these books, and you were covering his life and you were telling his story and telling people that these treasures were out there. First of all, let me ask you, if you did find these treasures, who would you contact to let know that these treasures were out there?
Someone dealing with Freemasonry.
Okay.
Several people, actually.
Okay.
So, not just one person, but several.
Okay. Secondly, what do you think Jesse would tell you? What do you think he would encourage you to go out and find these treasures and to turn them back over to Freemasonry? Or do you think he would tell you to leave well enough alone and just let his legacy lie and just tell his story?
We've been asked that, actually, by a couple of people. One Freemason asked my mother that, and our reasoning was, if he didn't want it known, he wouldn't have left the clues in his diary, and he wouldn't have left the treasure maps behind for the family to pass down. I'd say that was an inheritance, getting a treasure map, because that opened the door to a whole new world to me that just the knowledge alone in a lot of that is worth more than most treasures could. And it's something no one can take from you. Mm-hmm. So that alone is a great treasure. Just the knowledge, the doors that this has opened to history that I never would have dreamed existed had this not been part of my family legacy. It's amazing to me at all the knowledge that's been gained over the last 25 years of research with this. And I wouldn't have it any other way.
What lesson do you think Jesse James was trying to teach people? If there was a lesson that he had to teach people?
That's a good question. That's a tough question, actually. I don't know if he was trying to teach a lesson. I really don't. I know he taught his kids to be, he tried to teach his children to be honest and upstanding. He brought them up. And what's interesting is he brought them up to be, well, I would say of good character. Like he was a Mason trying to raise his children to be of good character and everything that a Mason should stand for. Some it worked, with the other half of his children, it didn't work too well, but, I guess that falls in line with any population, really. Some people sure. It works, some people it doesn't stick. Yeah. So lessons, I don't really know. That's a good question. I'd have to think on that a lot longer. I don't know if he was trying to leave a lesson other than just to pass on his morals to his children. And he always raised them never to be thieves. Now, I remember some of the older relatives of mine say, I thought, wow, he must have, there was something. And that also leads me just to, again, to believe that there was a lot more to it than just being a common outlaw. He had a purpose. If he was a common outlaw, he wouldn't have been burying gold in different places that he knew he'd never touch. So
why do you think he never got the opportunity to come forward and be able to tell a story and be able to clear his name? What opportunity never came his way that he could do that?
One of his brother Masons had asked him if he wanted to, what name he wanted to be buried under. And his quote to that Mason, it was passed down through his family, was, a name to live by is a name to, a name to live by is a name to die by. And that was his mindset. They said he had a very dry sense of humor, but he didn't talk a whole lot, but when he did talk, it was usually had a lot of meaning to it. Mm-hmm. And he was a serious guy. He had a sense of humor, but it was really dry. he was also very paranoid. And it, well, it seemed to at first, back, especially back in the 1870s, he would write so-and-so, like a somebody would ride up to his house claiming something, and he would write, "or so they say." Or they'd tell him their name, and he would always write down, "or so they say." And I thought that was interesting. And it's like he didn't believe them. And I guess he had good reason not to believe them, because he himself wasn't who he was claiming to be. So I think he was a very complicated person, but I think overall he was a decent person. He wasn't an angel by any means, but he also wasn't the monster that some had painted him out to be.
It just sounds to me
in the end, he was a good guy. Yeah.
It just sounded to me like he believed in the dual nature of people, and that there's definitely two sides to everybody.
That's true.
You know, because I mean, look at the people in his life. The people in his life all had dual natures.
That's true. And he, of all people, should have known that. I mean, he went from one of the most feared killers during the Civil War in that part of the nation to, you know, he was also the son of a Baptist preacher.
So yeah.
there's a lot of odd, I guess, polarizations throughout his life and his character, too. It's interesting.
Yeah. And a fascinating character study indeed. I mean, you know, whether, you know, I mean, I'm sure there are some people who are probably listening to this program thinking that, you know, Jesse probably died when he dusted off that picture.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm sure a lot of people are going, wow, you know, I'm glad he got that second chance to live out life to a ripe old age and turn things around. You know, it's interesting what we're given in this life and how many times we're given a chance to turn things around.
That's true.
Yeah. And there's never an ending to the story, a firm ending to the story.
That's true.
There's always a redemption point in our story.
That's very true. And, you know, that was another thing, mentioning like things left down, the knowledge gained researching, when just researching the treasures alone, the symbolism behind the grid pattern, Christian, occult, and Jewish Kabbalah, different mixes of different parts of Kabbalah mixed, thrown in there for good measure. There was Sufi mysticism in parts of it. It opens your mind to a lot more than, and even to this day, after all that gematria I researched, I'll look at numbers and they took on a completely different meaning to me. Any number, driving down the highway, you'll see like a Interstate Highway 20 and I'm thinking 20, that's the number for this letter. And that it just goes on. It doesn't stop. I laugh about that a lot, but it's like, my God, can't you just think of it as a number and leave it at that? So, but it's interesting.
It's interesting. You say Sufi. Did Jesse get overseas by chance? Was it ever?
No, he had a lot of, as far as I know, there's legends that he did travel overseas. I don't know how true those are, and there's no evidence we found that proves that at all. But I do know, like late in his life, well, hell, even when he was in his 50s and 60s, he was writing to a man in New York City who was like a seer or a fortune teller. Mm-hmm. The man went by the name Zemindar, and I know Zemindar means landowner in India. And that's as much as I've found. I can't find this Zemindar, who he was, what he was, but he was allegedly a fortune teller. I know in that time in U.S. history, that was very popular, you know, the delving into fortune telling and all that kind of stuff. I thought it was interesting, but he truly thought he was going to die before he reached the age of 60 and ended up dying at the age of 97. I thought there was a lot of interesting stories in there, and I'd like to track down who this Zemindar was. It may have been a contact for something completely different. I don't know.
I know a lot of our listeners probably aren't familiar with the Sufi village, but if you're not, look it up or just Google it. It's very interesting. They're one of the only villages in anywhere overseas that completely believe in the language. They have a universal word for love. And this word is the center of their language. So everything is centered around love, and they open their hearts to every stranger that comes through their village. So essentially it's an amazing culture. But yeah. their culture is as old as the world itself. And they're an amazing, I keep using the word amazing, but they simply are. They're an amazing culture. So I think it's Sufi is S-O-U-F-I. Is that how it's spelled, I believe?
I thought the way I spelled it was S-U-F-I, but
S-U-F-I?
I'm not
sure. Okay, it may be S-U-F-I. I may be misspelling it, but S-U-F-I. If you get a chance, Google it. Look up the culture and read up on it. It's very intriguing. Very intriguing. And get to know it a little bit. Expand your world a little bit, because it's an amazing culture.
It is.
Daniel, I want to thank you so much for this visit today. The book is Secret History of the Wild Wild West: Outlaws, Secret Societies, and the Hidden Agenda of the Elites. Daniel J. Duke is the author of that book, as well as Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure. All of that available at authordanielduke.com, which we've got a link to that website. We've got a link to the book itself on our description of this program. So just click on either of the links in the description of this program. You'll be able to get a hold of all three of Daniel's books in the description of this program. Dan, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me. It's been an honor.
It's been our pleasure, sir, and we definitely appreciate you. Folks, want to remind you that, again, it's been a little colder out there. It's been a little bit of a darker world. We want to remind you that you can cast some light into the darkness. And just this weekend, as you're headed out there, you know, we're one weekend out from Labor Day. If there's someone out there that needs a helping hand, or you see somebody out there that just needs a bit of your help, just take 5 minutes and do a little something for somebody out there. Maybe they need $5. Maybe they need a sandwich. Maybe it's just somebody who needs a jump, you know, with their car. Maybe it's somebody who just needs a smile. Maybe somebody needs to see a smile off of your face and needs a brighten up to their day. You can make a difference in the world, and it doesn't take much to do. If we all help each other out just a little bit in our weekends, we can make this world a better place, and we can leave it better than what we found it. And we need to start doing that in this world, and we need to come together a little bit more in this world to make it a better place. And I believe we can do it, and do it quickly, and we need to do it quickly. Our world doesn't need to fall apart before we make it better. We can make it better before it falls apart. And I truly do believe that. I'm going to go out and do that this weekend, and I hope you join me in doing that this weekend. Just go out and make somebody's life a little bit easier this weekend by doing just a little something. Just do it for your buddy Timmy, your buddies here at Darkness Radio. For Beer City Bruiser, for Mally Fox, for Jessica Freeberg, I'm Tim Dennis. Join us again next week for another great week of shows right here on the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.